A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Welcome back to My Weird Prompts. Here's one from Daniel, and it's a big one. He's asking about Ecclesiastes, or Kohelet, as it's known in Hebrew, and how it's been interpreted across the sweep of Jewish tradition. This is the book that opens with vanity of vanities, all is vanity, and somehow ends with fear God and keep his commandments. The most pessimistic book in the Bible was almost booted from the canon entirely, and the rabbis who saved it had to basically invert its meaning to do so. So where do we even start?
We start with the fact that this book nearly didn't make it into the Bible at all. And I mean that literally. There's a recorded debate in the Mishnah, Yadayim chapter 3, Mishnah 5, where the sages are arguing about whether Kohelet defiles the hands, which is their technical term for, is this scripture or not? The school of Shammai said no, it's not holy. The school of Hillel said yes, it is, and Hillel won.
Defiles the hands. That's the phrase they use for holy books. Something about the sacredness being so potent, it required ritual hand washing after touching the scroll. I love that the rabbinic mind went straight to this text is spiritually radioactive, as its seal of authenticity.
It's wonderfully concrete. And the fact that Shammai's school wanted to exclude Kohelet tells you something. They weren't wrong about what the book says. Read it straight through and you get passages that sound like they were written by someone who's given up on everything. Wisdom, pleasure, labor, justice. The fate of the fool will befall me too. Why then have I been so very wise? That's chapter 2, verse 15. This is not the standard piety of Proverbs or Psalms.
Yet Hillel's school fought to keep it. Not reluctantly, they actively argued for its inclusion, which means they saw something in the book that Shammai missed, or they had a way of reading it that neutralized the threat.
And this is where we need to establish the core textual problem before we get into the interpretive history. The book contradicts itself. Chapter 1, verse 2. Vanity of vanities, says Kohelet. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. The Hebrew is Hevel Havalim. Vapor of vapors, breath of breaths. Everything is insubstantial, fleeting, like trying to grab smoke. But then you get to chapter 12, verse 13, the very end. The end of the matter, all having been heard, fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole of man. Those two statements do not sit easily together.
It reads like someone stapled a disclaimer onto the end. The preceding book was a work of experimental despair. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect those of the management.
That's actually one of the theories, that the pious ending was added by a later editor precisely because the book was too radical to circulate without it. Think of it like a medieval book that needed an imprimatur to avoid being burned. But the rabbis of the Talmudic period didn't take that route. They didn't say, ignore the first 11 chapters and focus on the ending. They reinterpreted the whole thing.
Before we get into how they reinterpreted it, let's pin down what we're actually dealing with. When was this written, and by whom?
Tradition says King Solomon, writing in his old age, the jaded king who'd had everything and found it all empty. And the book's opening line supports that framing, the words of Kohelet, son of David, king in Jerusalem. But the language is the giveaway. It's written in late biblical Hebrew with Aramaic influences, and it contains Persian loanwords. The word pardes, orchard, or park, in chapter 2, verse 5, comes from Persian. That word doesn't show up in earlier biblical Hebrew. Most scholars date it to the Persian or early Hellenistic period, roughly the 4th or 3rd century BCE, well after Solomon's time.
It's a pseudepigraphon, someone writing in Solomon's voice, using his persona as a literary device, which was a totally accepted practice in the ancient world. You wrote in the name of a revered figure to give your work authority.
And the persona is crucial. Kohelet, the name itself, probably means something like the assembler or the preacher, someone who gathers people or sayings. But by using Solomon's voice, the author gets to say things that would be unthinkable coming from a lesser figure. I build houses, I planted vineyards, I made gardens and parks. That works as Solomon. it doesn't work as some anonymous sage from the Persian period. Imagine a modern parallel. If you want to write a blistering critique of wealth and power, you don't publish it under your own name as a mid-level bureaucrat. You write it in the voice of a retired CEO who had it all and found it hollow.
The author is already doing something subversive before we even get to the content, using the most authoritative voice in the tradition to question the value of authority itself. It's like writing a book called Why I Was Wrong About Everything, and signing it with the name of the most successful person in history.
The rabbis who canonized the book understood this. They weren't naive. They knew what they were dealing with. The question is why they thought it was worth the trouble.
All right, so let's get into that. The rabbis had a book that seemed to say everything is pointless. What did they do with it?
They performed what I can only describe as one of the most brilliant acts of creative reinterpretation in literary history. Let's start with the Talmud, Tractate Shabbat, page 30a and b. The rabbis there are grappling with the fact that Kohelet seems to contradict itself, and they say, this is not a bug, it's a feature. The contradictions are intentional, they're a dialectic. Kohelet is staging a debate between different voices, and the apparent nihilism is a setup for the resolution.
That's an extraordinary move. Instead of papering over the contradictions, they elevate them to the status of a feature. Oh, you noticed it contradicts itself? That's because it's supposed to. It's like reading a Platonic dialogue and complaining that Socrates' interlocutors keep saying things that aren't true. The back and forth is the argument.
And the key interpretive move they make is around the word hevel. We translate it as vanity, because the Latin Vulgate used vanitas, and that's stuck in English ever since. But hevel literally means vapor or breath. It's about transience, not meaninglessness. Something can be fleeting without being worthless. Think of a sunset. It lasts maybe 10 minutes of really spectacular color, then it's gone. That doesn't make it meaningless. If anything, the brevity is part of what makes it beautiful.
Vanity of vanities should really be vapor of vapors. Everything is smoke. Everything slips through your fingers. That's a fundamentally different claim than everything is pointless. One is an observation about the nature of experience. The other is a value judgment.
And once you read Hevel as fleeting rather than meaningless, the whole book shifts. What's fleeting must be seized. The fact that life is short doesn't make it pointless. It makes it urgent. The Talmud in Shabbat 30a takes a verse like chapter 1, verse 3. What profit does a man have from all his labor? And reads profit, not as material gain, but as spiritual reward in the world to come. The labor is Torah study, and the profit is eternal.
That's a complete inversion. Your work is pointless, because your work has eternal significance. I'm trying to decide if that's brilliant or just extremely motivated reasoning.
It's both. And the rabbis would probably say, yes, it's motivated reasoning, and that's exactly how you're supposed to read scripture. The plain meaning, the peshat, is just one layer. There's also the darash, the interpreted meaning, and the remez, the hinted meaning, and the sod, the secret meaning. The text is a living thing that generates new meanings in every generation. It's not a fossil to be excavated. It's more like a score of music that needs to be performed to exist.
That's a helpful analogy. A musical score on paper isn't the music. It's instructions for making music, and different performers will bring out different things. The same notes, radically different experiences.
Some performances will be more faithful to the score than others, but even the most faithful performance involves interpretation, tempo, dynamics, phrasing. The rabbis would say the same about scripture. There's no such thing as reading without interpreting. The only question is whether you're aware of your interpretive moves or not.
Let's go deeper into the mechanics. How did they actually do this, verse by verse?
The move I find most ingenious is what they did with the phrase, under the sun. This phrase appears 29 times in Kohelet and only 3 times elsewhere in the entire Hebrew Bible. Kohelet keeps saying, there's nothing new under the sun, that everything in this world is repetitive and futile. The rabbis in Kohelet Rabbah, which is a midrashic commentary from around the 6th to 8th century CE, seized on this phrase and created a sharp dualism. They said, there is nothing new under the sun, but above the sun, everything is new.
Under the sun is the physical world. Above the sun is the spiritual world. And suddenly, the book isn't saying nothing matters. It's saying nothing in the material world ultimately matters. So focus on the spiritual. That's such a clean move. Two words. under the sun become the key that unlocks an entirely different book?
That dualism is not in the original Hebrew. The original text doesn't have a concept of above the sun. Kohelet uses under the sun as a way of saying, in this world, in human experience, it's not contrasting it with anything. But the rabbis turned it into a two-tiered reality that would have been completely foreign to the original author. It's like they found a door in the text that the author didn't know he'd built, and they walked through it into a whole new theological landscape.
Once you've established that framework, you can reinterpret practically anything. A generation goes and a generation comes. That's not existential despair. That's a reminder that the physical world is cyclical, and therefore not where meaning resides. The sun rises and the sun sets. Same thing. All those observations about natural cycles become evidence for the limitations of the material realm.
Then there's the Targum to Kohelet, which is an Aramaic translation from around the 7th century. Calling it a translation is generous. It's more like a paraphrase that rewrites the entire book as a straightforward religious sermon. Chapter 1, verse 2, Vanity of Vanities, All is Vanity, becomes in the Targum, Vanity of Vanities are the works of the wicked, all is vanity compared to the Torah. That's not translation, that's interpretive overriding. The Targum simply refuses to let Kohelet say what Kohelet says.
You have three moves happening more or less simultaneously. The Talmudic move of reading contradictions as dialectic. The Midrashic move of creating a heaven-earth dualism through under the sun. And the Targum's move of just rewriting the thing entirely. Each one is more aggressive than the last. By the time you get to the Targum, you're not even pretending to translate anymore. You're just fixing the book.
Then Saadia Gaon in the 10th century takes it even further. Saadia writes his commentary in Judeo-Arabic around the year 930, and it's one of the first systematic Jewish philosophical commentaries on any biblical book. He reads Kohelet as a rationalist argument for divine justice, structured as a Socratic dialogue. In his reading, the skeptical voice in the book, the one saying everything is pointless, is a hypothetical interlocutor. It's not the author's view. The author is Solomon, and Solomon is setting up a straw man to knock down. The final verse, fear God and keep his commandments, is the refutation, and everything leading up to it is the case being refuted.
That's almost too neat. Don't worry, the nihilism is just the bad guy's argument. Solomon wins in the end. It resolves the tension, but at the cost of making the book dramatically less interesting. I mean, who wants to read 11 chapters of wrong opinions just to get to the one verse that corrects them?
I think that's a fair criticism. But it also shows you what Saadia was up against. He was living in the Islamic world, engaging with Muslim philosophers like the Mu'tazilites, and he needed to show that Jewish scripture was philosophically rigorous. A book that seemed to deny meaning and justice was a liability, so he turned it into a work of apologetics. He was playing defense, essentially, protecting the tradition from external critique by making the problematic text into something a rationalist could respect.
The rabbinic approach held for nearly 1,000 years. But then came the philosophers, the mystics, and eventually the moderns, each of whom found something new in Kohelet's ancient words.
Let's talk about Maimonides. In the Guide for the Perplexed, Part 3, Chapter 54, he reads Kohelet as a treatise on the intellectual love of God. For Maimonides, vanity is anything that distracts from the contemplation of the divine. The book isn't saying life is meaningless. It's saying that most of what we chase is a distraction from the one thing that matters, which is knowing God through the intellect.
That's a very Maimonidean move. Everything becomes about intellectual perfection. The pleasures Kohelet describes, wine, women, building projects, gardens, those are all lower pursuits that keep you from philosophy. It's almost Platonic, the cave versus the sun. And I can see how that works as a reading, but it also feels like it flattens the book. Kohelet isn't just saying pleasure is a distraction from contemplation. He's saying he tried contemplation too, and that also felt like vapor.
That's the part Maimonides has to work hardest to explain away. When Kohelet says, I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly, I perceive that this also is a striving after wind. Maimonides reads that as referring to incomplete knowledge, not knowledge itself. The frustration isn't with wisdom. It's with wisdom pursued for the wrong reasons or without reaching its proper object. It's an elegant move, but you can feel the strain.
And then you have Gersonides in the 14th century, Rabbi Levi ben Gershon, who takes a radically different approach. His commentary on Kohelet from 1328 was so controversial, it was printed with omissions in some early editions. Gersonides reads the book as a deterministic argument. He takes chapter 9, verse 11, "The race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong," and says, "This proves that human effort is futile, because everything is preordained by the stars and the active intellect."
That's a genuinely dangerous reading. If everything is predetermined, why keep the commandments? Why study Torah? Gersonides is basically saying the book endorses astral determinism. And he wasn't shy about it. He was a serious astronomer and astrologer, and he believed that celestial bodies influenced human affairs. So for him, this wasn't a hypothetical reading. It was the correct reading, and the implications were real.
Which is why it was nearly censored. What exactly happened with that?
The Vilna Gaon in the 18th century actually banned certain Kabbalistic commentaries on Kohelet that he considered too antinomian, too close to saying that since everything is vanity, the law doesn't matter. There's a real tension here. The book's radicalism keeps resurfacing no matter how many layers of interpretation you pile on top. It's like trying to bury something that insists on floating back up. Every century or so, someone reads Kohelet and says, "Wait, this actually means what it says," and the tradition has to scramble to recontain it.
Then the Kabbalists come along and do something completely different. They don't try to contain the radicalism. They embrace it, but they reinterpret what the radicalism is about.
The Zohar, in Volume 3, page 78a, reinterprets Hevel as a reference to the Sephira of Tiferet, which is beauty, balance, the central channel in the Kabbalistic tree of divine emanations. So vanity of vanities, Hevel Habilim, becomes a description of the divine structure that sustains the world. The book is suddenly a coded mystical text about the inner workings of the Godhead.
I'm trying to imagine the original author of Kohelet hearing that his book about how everything is vapor is actually a manual for understanding the structure of the divine. He'd either laugh or weep.
But that's exactly the point. The Kabbalists weren't trying to recover the original meaning. They were trying to find the Torah's inner truth, which they believed was encoded in every letter. Kohelet's apparent pessimism was just the outer shell. Crack it open, and you find the secrets of creation. It's like finding a note that says everything is pointless, and deciding that pointless is actually an anagram for the name of God. The surface meaning is almost irrelevant.
Then we get to the Hasidic reading, which might be my favorite. The Baal Shem Tov, and especially Rebbe Nachman of Breslov, read Kohelet as a manual for joy through despair.
Rebbe Nachman in Likertei Moharan, Part 2, Teaching 8, says that the recognition of vanity, the full, crushing awareness that worldly pursuits are empty, is the gateway to deveket, to cleaving to God. You have to go through the despair. You can't skip it. Hevel isn't the problem, it's the door. His famous teaching, the whole world is a narrow bridge, and the main thing is not to be afraid. That's a Kohelet inflected spirituality. The world is precarious, everything is fleeting, and the appropriate response is not to despair, but to move forward with trust.
That's profound. The Hasidic move is to say, yes, the book is as dark as it seems. Yes, everything really is vapor. And that's exactly why you can be joyful. Because once you accept the vaporness of everything, you're free. You're not clinging to things that will inevitably slip away. It's almost Buddhist in its logic. Suffering comes from attachment, and attachment comes from the illusion that things are permanent.
That's a comparison people have made, though we should be careful not to flatten either tradition. But the structural parallel is real. Rebbe Nachman himself reportedly struggled with profound depression, and his teachings on joy aren't naive. They're hard won. He's not saying, just be happy. He's saying the path to joy goes directly through the recognition of emptiness. That's a very different thing.
That brings us to the modern period, where the readings get even more varied. Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, in The Lonely Man of Faith from 1965, uses Kohelet as a proof text for what he calls covenantal man, the person who experiences the full absurdity of existence, but chooses faith anyway. Soloveitchik doesn't try to resolve the contradictions. He says the contradiction eyes the religious life. You feel the absurdity, and you commit anyway.
That's very different from Saadia Gaon's approach. Saadia says the skeptic is wrong, and Solomon refutes him. Soloveitchik says the skeptic is right, and you commit to God in full knowledge of that rightness. It's faith without illusions. It's the difference between saying, I believe because I've resolved all my doubts, and I believe despite the fact that my doubts are unresolvable. The second one is, I think, both harder and more honest.
It resonates with a lot of 20th century existentialism. Camus saying we must imagine Sisyphus happy. That's not so far from Soloveitchik's Covenantal Man. The absurdity is acknowledged, not denied, and the response is commitment rather than despair.
Then, on the other side, you have the secular Zionist readings. Ahad Haum and Micah Joseph Berdyczewski read Kohelet as a proto-existentialist who rejects religious certainty. For them, Kohelet is the voice of honest doubt in a tradition that often demands certainty. They see him as a hero precisely because he says what the pious don't want to hear. He's the internal critic who keeps the tradition honest.
In the span of 2,000 years, Kohelet has been read as a defense of Torah study, a rationalist argument for divine justice, a manual for intellectual contemplation, a deterministic treatise, a coded Kabbalistic text, a guide to joy through despair, a model of covenantal faith, and a proto-existentialist manifesto. That's quite a resume for a book that opens by saying everything is pointless.
Every one of those readings is grounded in something that's actually in the text. That's what makes it so remarkable. The book is ambiguous. It contains multitudes. The interpretive tradition didn't impose meanings on a text that resisted them. It drew out meanings that were latent in the text's own complexity. It's like the book is a prism, and every generation turns it and finds a different color.
Let's talk about the mistranslation issue more directly. You mentioned that vanity comes from the Latin vanitas. What does that do to how people read the book?
It's enormous. Vanitas in Latin has connotations of emptiness, worthlessness, pride, futility. It's a much heavier word than Hebel. When Jerome translated Hebel as vanitas in the Vulgate, he set the entire Western interpretive tradition on a particular path. The English vanity inherits that. So centuries of Christian and later secular readers have encountered a book that seems to be saying everything is worthless, which is a much more nihilistic claim than everything is fleeting.
Everything is fleeting is something almost everyone can agree with. It's not a metaphysical claim about meaning. It's an observation about the nature of experience. Moments don't last. You can't hold on to anything. That's not a controversial statement. It's almost banal. But everything is worthless. That's a philosophical grenade.
And the Jewish interpretive tradition, by and large, understood this because they were reading the Hebrew. They knew Hevel meant vapor. So even when they did elaborate reinterpretations, they were working with a more nuanced concept than the Latin tradition. It's a fascinating case study in how translation choices ripple through centuries of theology. One word choice by Jerome in a monastery in the 4th century shaped how millions of people understood an entire book of scripture.
What about the hedonistic passages? Chapter 9, verses 7 through 9. Go, eat your bread with joy, and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already approved your works. Let your garments be always white, and let not your head lack oil. Enjoy life with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life.
That's a fascinating test case because it's one of the few passages where the book seems to offer positive advice, and yet the tradition has consistently downplayed it. The rabbis read, "Eat your bread with joy," as a reference to the festive meals of Sabbaths and holidays. "Let your garments be always white" becomes a reference to ritual purity. The plain sense, enjoy food, enjoy sex, enjoy the good things in life because that's all you've got, gets spiritualized into something much safer.
Even when Kohelet seems to be saying something relatively straightforward and life-affirming, the tradition can't quite let it stand. There's always another layer. It's almost as if the tradition is more comfortable with the nihilistic passages, because those can be reinterpreted as spiritual urgency, than with the hedonistic ones, which just say, enjoy yourself.
That raises an interesting question. Is there a reading of Kohelet that the tradition cannot absorb? What happens when interpretive flexibility reaches its limit?
The hedonism might be that limit. The tradition can handle nihilism. It just reinterprets it as spiritual urgency. It can handle determinism. It turns it into a discussion about free will. It can handle doubt. It makes doubt a stage on the path to faith. But a straightforward eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die, that's harder to domesticate.
Because it doesn't require reinterpretation to be coherent. You can just take it at face value and live accordingly. No Torah study required, no world to come, no divine emanations. Just enjoy your life. It's a self-contained philosophy that needs no institutional support.
Which might explain why the pious ending of chapter 12 is there. Some editor looked at this book and said, "We need to add something so people don't walk away thinking the takeaway is party. It's the ancient equivalent of a content warning."
Yet the party is in there. The text contains it. The tradition can't make it disappear. It can only redirect attention elsewhere. That's the thing about canonized texts. Once they're in, you're stuck with everything in them. You can interpret, you can allegorize, you can translate creatively, but you can't delete the verses that make you uncomfortable.
What does this 2,500-year history of creative interpretation mean for us, sitting here in the 21st century, trying to make sense of a world that often feels as fleeting as vapor?
I think there are three practical takeaways. The first is about how we read texts in general. The Jewish interpretive tradition teaches that meaning is not fixed. It's co-created by the reader and the community. Kohelet survived not despite creative misreading, but because of it. The fact that every generation reinvented the book is a feature, not a bug, of a living tradition.
That's a useful insight for anyone who's ever felt trapped by a text, religious or otherwise. The meaning isn't locked in at the moment of composition. And that's not a failure of fidelity. It's how texts stay alive.
The second takeaway is for anyone dealing with existential despair. The Jewish tradition offers a toolkit here, and it's remarkably practical. Option 1, the rabbinic move. Reframe vanity as fleeting opportunity. If everything passes, then this moment matters precisely because it won't last. Option 2, the Hasidic move. Go through the despair rather than around it. Recognize the emptiness fully and let that recognition open something new. Option 3, the Soloveitchik move. Choose faith or commitment despite absurdity. Not because you've resolved the doubts, but because you've accepted them.
Those are different strategies. The rabbinic one is cognitive reframing. The Hasidic one is almost a form of exposure therapy. Sit with the worst feeling until it transforms. And the Soloveitchik one is existential commitment. Kierkegaard by way of the Talmud. Different people will need different ones at different points in their lives.
The third takeaway is a practical exercise. Read Kohelet with a traditional commentary. Rashi, Ibn Ezra, or the Matsuda translation with footnotes, and notice how the commentary transforms the plain meaning. Then try writing your own commentary on a verse that bothers you. What would it take to make that verse say something you could live with? The exercise teaches you about your own assumptions and about the interpretive moves you make without realizing it.
That's a good homework assignment, and it connects to something bigger. As AI and large language models change how we read and interpret texts, and this is not hypothetical anymore, it's happening. The Jewish tradition's millennia-long experiment in interpretive creativity offers a model. Ancient texts don't stay alive by being preserved in amber. They stay alive by being read in radically new contexts by people who refuse to let them become irrelevant.
The rabbis who saved Kohelet understood something profound. A tradition that can't handle doubt isn't strong, it's brittle. A tradition that can take its most skeptical book and turn it into a cornerstone of wisdom is one that's built to last.
That brings us back to the canonization debate we started with. The school of Shammai wanted to exclude Kohelet because it was dangerous. The school of Hillel fought to include it for exactly the same reason. They understood that a scripture without shadows isn't a scripture at all. It's propaganda.
The book that says Vanity of Vanities, All is Vanity, turned out to be one of the most generative texts in the entire tradition. Every generation found itself in it. Every generation argued with it. And that argument is still going.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1810s, dyers in South Sudan discovered that fermenting the leaves of the Indigofera erecta plant in clay pots lined with camel urine produced a blue dye so color-fast that British textile merchants initially accused local traders of fraud, believing the vivid fabric had been painted rather than dyed.
Right. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you have a weird prompt of your own, send it to prompts@myweirdprompts.com. We're produced by Hilbert Flumingtop, and we'll be back next time with whatever strange question lands in the inbox.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.